Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In late February, Ahmaud Arbery was out jogging in a Georgian neighborhood when he was shot three times at close range and killed by two men who say they thought he was burglarizing the neighborhood. It took nearly 2 months for arrests to be made and charges filed following the release of cell phone videos showing the incident. Ahmaud Arbery's name is now added to a list of young African-American men and women who have lost their lives through altercations with vigilantes or police. CNN reports that in Charlotte alone, there have been three controversial killings of black men by police in 6 years. This latest incident reignites the conversation about the challenges of being black in America. This double standard calls into question everything we say we believe about justice, and as these killings continue, one wonders what can be done to curb them. We explore that this hour with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard University, and the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. He joins us from somewhere in the heartland of New Jersey. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
At-large City Councilman Braxton Winston rose to prominence following the police shooting here of Keith Lamont Scott in 2017. During the protests that followed, if you recall, a police officer suggested if Winston really advocated change, he should run for office. He did. He won. He joins us now. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. And Derek Anderson is Executive Director of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, a collaboration of community stakeholders who partner in efforts to reduce disproportionality and disparities in the criminal justice system, some of which we're witnessing daily at the national level. Thank you for joining us, Derek. Welcome back.
Welcome, Mike. Good morning.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's radio, so you have to talk. I just want to remind you of that. So let me begin with you, Khalil. We've talked about this on this program before, about how racial profiling and about the dual application of justice and how it's been well known in the black community forever. It's just now beginning, I think, to come into the consciousness of other people because we don't live it every day. And a large part of the reasons it's coming into our consciousness is because of the existence of police body cam footage and cell phone video, because everybody seems to have a cell phone at these altercations all of a sudden, and we're seeing what really happens. So before we talk about the history of this and why this has built up over time, do you think that the fact that we have these cell phone videos is making a difference? Is it moving the needle?
Well, that's a two-part question. It is making a difference with regard to holding police and or citizens accountable when it comes to making arrests or giving protesters and family members and their lawyers the evidence they need to pursue a prosecution. And so in that sense, there's no question that cell phone video is making a difference. You can look at the killing of Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, which did lead to an eventual indictment. On the second point, is it moving the needle? It's not clear at all. And you could say in many ways, the needle is as stagnant as it has been for 100 years around these issues.
And the evidence that it's not moving the needle is that these incidents continue? Is that what you're saying?
No, actually, the evidence is even clearer than that. The evidence is that in many of these cases, whether it is individuals or police officers are not, in fact, punished and convicted for these crimes. So the vast majority are acquitted when it comes to killing of unarmed African-Americans, including women. The second is that when the 2016 election drew attention to the organizing of Black Lives Matter activists, every single national police union joined forces with then candidate Donald Trump, who was running on a law and order campaign, a kind of new version of what happened in the 70s and 80s, and rallied behind him in defense of all that the Black Lives Matter activism had been arguing for, which was essentially police accountability and for new rules limiting the use of force. So we elected a president nationally who essentially wanted to double down on the kind of policing that the activists had been fighting against.
Your book, The Condemnation of Blackness, makes the argument, I believe, that the idea of black criminality was crucial to making modern urban America. That's an interesting point of view. How crucial? How so?
Well, oftentimes we think about racist ideas as things that died a painful and justifiable death in the distant past. And so a long time ago, like people like Thomas Jefferson, for example, used to argue that black people's hair texture or their body odor indicated a fundamental biological difference. Others looked at the size of people's brains, the cadavers, and they studied them. But in the end, the scientists could not nail down a fundamental racial difference between blacks and whites. But what did stick in American culture and society was the idea that African Americans were a threat, a dangerous threat to civil society. And so the very act of freedom for African Americans became criminalized in our society.
Did that develop, that fear of African Americans, develop organically? Did it come out of the fact that at the height of slavery, in the South at least, African Americans outnumbered the white population, and that, unless you controlled them, that could get out of hand, and the white people could be in trouble. Is that where that started?
Well, Mike, you're a super sharp guy, but that data point isn't right.
Okay, all right.
The African American population never surpassed 20% in the total population of the U.S. And in the South, the state of South Carolina had particular counties that were overwhelmingly black. Most southern states always had overwhelmingly dominant white populations to control the African-American population. So, if you looked at the county level or the parish level of Louisiana, you could find significant populations of majority blacks. But yes, the idea out of slavery was that violence was the primary instrument of terror and submission and control of black people who posed a constant threat in pursuit of their own freedom. And most certainly that anxiety and the apparatus of policing, which were slave patrols, and then in freedom became modern police departments in not a linear relationship. Policing had many more concerns than just black people. That did carry over.
And that fear of the other, that fear of black people was stoked, was it not, during Reconstruction, during Jim Crow, as a means to deny people their liberty, their freedom, because they had rights. Black people had rights. They could vote all of a sudden. And that scared people.
Yeah, well, yes, but you have to think about this not just in terms of like the irrational fear. The use of violence to control black people was instrumental. It served the purpose of limiting access to the ballot box. So we've lived through a time where we saw at the border in the United States, for example, the way that Border Patrol and ICE and the caging of children and family separation was a deliberate policy of self-deportation. The idea was to make coming to America so dangerous for people that people simply wouldn't do it. And that's how violence was used in the South, to keep people from the ballot box, to keep people from moving into neighborhoods, to keep people from standing proud and strong in defense of their own property and liberty when they were challenged by white people. And so violence has always been very instrumental. The problem is that the notion of black people as criminals was the defense of that violence. It's what made the violence legitimate, because as you point out, because black people had political rights, you couldn't say, well, we just shot him because he wanted to vote. They said, we shot him because he was a threat to my wife, or he was a threat to my neighborhood, or he broke into my home.
And before we just paint the South with this broad brush of racism and fear of African Americans, this is a phenomenon that is not limited to the South. This happens all over the country, and these shootings, these altercations with vigilantes and police happen all over the country. They certainly happened in New York City, which is the North, and the North fought a war over slavery to end it. How do you explain that the message of fear of black people spread into other parts of the country? after they
Well, it's a
fought a
great,
war?
sure, it's a great question. And I'm glad you brought it up because in many ways, I have, as a researcher, focused more on the North than on the South. And one way to think about the conversation we've just had about slavery and its ties and the way that the South was organized around violence, particularly vigilante violence or mob violence, is that police officers in the North often took on the function of policing the boundaries of Black life, particularly in the wake of the Great Migration, beginning around World War I in the 1910s, but carrying through the next several decades. And the evidence we have for the relationship of policing to stoking fears or responding to fears of Black criminality are a series of police brutality commissions, the first of which occurred after 20 race riots. And let me just be clear, race riots in the early 20th century were riots directed by whites against the Black community, usually in response to concerns about Black people moving into white areas. Chicago produced the first Blue Ribbon Commission, published in 1922, and was unmistakable and clear in its language about the relationship of white police officers to supporting white homeowners in keeping Blacks out of their neighborhood. Same happened in New York in 1935 and 43. Watts was the first riot that shifted the focus from Blacks against property ownership and police. But these police brutality commissions, all the way through the Kerner Report in 1968, continued. New York in 1994, Los Angeles again, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Detroit, New Orleans, Seattle, Cleveland, New York again, Albuquerque, Portland, Baltimore, Los Angeles, all the way up to Chicago in 2017 with the shooting of Laquan McDonald. So, yes, Mike, this has been a national problem for a century.
And it goes against our professed values as Americans because we keep saying equality for all. It's in our founding documents, etc. How do you explain that? Are we the people being manipulated, or are we the people driving this? We're telling our public officials this is what we have wanted traditionally.
Yeah, well, we began essentially as a frontier nation. And within that context, violence was the primary means for creating the American nation, which is that we use violence to displace indigenous populations from their land. North Carolina is certainly rich with that history, as well as many parts of the West. And so when we, the people, became the founding notion of our democracy, that we was not inclusive, this most of us know. But we've been struggling with making real the possibility of multiracial democracy. We've had fits and starts. We've had moments of breakthrough. Most certainly the civil rights movement represented that. But after the civil rights movement, many of your listeners will know, we built the biggest system of unfreedom within the criminal justice system the world has ever known. No other country has caged or locked up people as a matter of basic civil governance than the United States of America. And so we've always had a contradictory relationship to our professed commitment to freedom and the instruments of imprisonment and terror and control to make sure that that freedom was shared by only a certain population and not everyone.
So I have about 20 seconds left, but is that intentional? I mean, have we done this consciously, or this just happened because we fear fear?
It has been intentional, Mike, in policy. It has been unintentional, in some voters, being, convinced that this was the right way to go.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is with Harvard University. We're also here with Braxton Winston and Derek Anderson. We'll talk to them when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. He is a professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard University. Braxton Winston, at-large city council member, and Derek Anderson is here, executive director of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. We've been talking about the history of this misapplication or this dual system of justice with the sharp end of the stick pointed squarely at the African-American population. We just talked about how we have this enormous prison population in this country, the largest percentage of which are African-American men who are incarcerated, sometimes for very flimsy excuses, let's put it that way. Derek, your organization, Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, has been working hard toward a time when, according to your mission statement's words, the composition of outcomes of juvenile courts cannot be predicted by race or ethnicity. Where would you say we are on that journey?
Hey, Mike, thank you. I would say, as you know, we didn't get here overnight. And so the other thing to recognize is that there are no quick fixes. But I would like to say that through our relationships and through our collaboration with our partners, we are making some strides. One of the things we truly believe is that we look at things through a racial equity lens. And so the first part of that process is really beginning to how we disaggregate our data by race and ethnicity and gender, but also begin to look at geographically where those numbers are. And so it was a process. It was a process to get there. Race Matters for Juvenile Justice have been in existence for 10 years. And so we have been making strides over the last few years. But the first part of that process was really about building relationships with systems and institutions. Building relationships with system leaders, want to first willing to disaggregate their data, willing to share their data, and then willing to own that there is a problem of disproportionality within their own home system. The next part of that process was around developing a common language, developing common terms and definitions. And so as a team, we participated in two-day racial equity workshops, count as a foundation for us to really understand why this problem is so systemic. The other thing about our organization is that our primary focus is institution organizing for practice change. We look at the structure and equities embedded in policy, procedures, and practices that are causing disparity and disproportionality. And I think as part of our partner organizations that we're in relationship with, we are beginning to see, to some degree, some small things happening. But the first part of that process is really looking at our policies through a racial equity lens.
I was going to ask if, as you've gone through this process over the last several years, have you learned anything you didn't know? And has the other side, the perpetrators of this, learned anything that they didn't know? And is that moving anything in the right direction?
I would say yes, we're hopeful through this process. Even if you look at our data over the last 5 years, when you look at juvenile justice at a state level, even a local level, what the research data shows that the number of youth that have been incarcerated with youth detention center are going down. However, disproportionately, African-American males are still the highest represented in those groups. And we look at over the last 5 year trend, Mecklenburg County, as well as the state of North Carolina. And so even though the number are going down, the disproportionate rate of black males are still the highest every year across those systems.
I think sometimes as a society at large, we're like the frog in the boiling pot of water. We don't realize things until they're too apparent to deny, and then it's too late in some cases to do that. Is that where we are here? Is that what happened with, for instance, the criminal justice system, where we have so many black men incarcerated, sometimes for the smallest of infractions of the law that white people would not be in jail for? Is that because we didn't notice it? We didn't see it until recently?
I would not say. I think we have noticed it. This has been go ahead, Braxton, you want to say something?
Yes, he does.
Yeah, well, I will say that, in many communities, there has been no frog in a boiling pot of water. I mean, people have been flailing and beating on the walls and beating on the tables for generations, saying that this is happening and that this is wrong. And to kind of speak to some earlier points, it's not necessarily that we have the video, that is going to change that, because it's about who gets to see those videos and who cares when they see those videos or the evidence to do something about it. So this has been happening for a long time.
But don't you think that these videos are acting not unlike the way the early newscasts that reported from Selma I think the incident with the dogs and the hoses, the fire hoses during the civil rights movement that was finally on television because television finally had the capability of covering things remotely, that shocked the nation. That woke a lot of people up. It also informed a lot of people about something that was going on that they never realized. They never noticed it because they were never in those situations. Isn't the cell phone video functioning the same way?
Well, it's one thing to know that something exists. It's another thing to see it. And then it's a whole separate thing to do the work to change the underlying issues and the underlying systems that allow those things to happen. You have these situations where a lot of people clutch their pearls when they see things, but not a lot changes because people are afraid to do the work. This is something that I've run into, or I shouldn't say afraid to do the work, but are not willing to do the work for whatever reason. We think of, for instance, last year during our police shooting of Danquirius Franklin, as you might recall, we had body cam footage, but nobody would have actually known what happened if it was not for a mistake that a CMPD officer showed city council too much of the video, more that was even presented, to the judge at that point in time. And we didn't even know that within our policies, there were certain structures within the city of Charlotte and CMPD that prevented the judicial system from even knowing that there was more video to consider. This is after the state legislature put in a law that prevented the dissemination of these police body cams without a court order after police departments all around the state started implementing body cam footage. So you see how the layers of structure are intentionally put there to make things more difficult to change. But the general public doesn't necessarily know that these things are happening. And this is what they're voting for, as I alluded to early in the conversation.
But these incidents get a lot of coverage on television. They engender conversations like the one we're having now. We've done scads of public conversations about this. Derek, I'm just curious, in your work with law enforcement, if this has opened their eyes to a problem that they may be reluctant to admit they have, but nonetheless, it is beginning to sink in.
Right. One of the things going back to build off what other colleagues were saying, when we think about how poor communities of color have been under siege by systems and institutions that derive them of power for years and for decades. And so that pattern has always existed. But when you look at local law enforcement, CMPD has done a great job in partnering, working with us, and not only looking to begin to look at their policy, procedures, and practices, but also engaging with other systems, whether that's Department of Social Service, whether it's the school system, the court system, to look at collectively as a group, how do we really focus on our policies and procedures, practice, and training? The other thing we talk about is this whole notion around implicit bias and how implicit bias shows up in our data decision making. Even when you have policies, procedures, and practices, there's still an element of implicit bias and how it shows up within our systems and institutions. But I think there we have come in contact with some individuals who probably don't recognize that they have bias, or they're not biased toward people of color, or they treat other people fairly. And I would say in some of our experience through some different law enforcement that has taken place, but it's not just in law enforcement, it's in every system and institution.
Khalil, are these new conversations that we're having in the 21st century, or have these conversations been had in previous centuries, in the 20th century, during the Civil Rights Movement, during Jim Crow, during Reconstruction, going back to the 1800s? I guess what I'm asking, have we had these conversations before? And if we have, if we're having them now, did it make a difference?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming back to the social media and this video challenge, because it is somewhat counterintuitive. In the moment, we feel the deluge of media coverage. It seems like there's a lot of thoughtful, intense scrutiny. We've heard from the governor, Brian Kemp in Georgia, saying, we want swift justice in this case. And all of a sudden, after 2 months of organizing, there seems to be real accountability that might play out in the case of Arbery. But I have to remind you that 8 years ago, Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman on February 26th. The Sanford Police Department took him in for questioning, released him, took his story, and only by dint not of a massive outpouring of middle-class white people watching the news was there an actual movement towards justice, but of Black people, just like the local Black folks in the case of Georgia, of Brunswick, Georgia, fighting for justice. If I bring up the case of Eric Garner, almost everybody in America knows the story of I Can't Breathe. And yet in that case, the officer who put him in an illegal chokehold was not prosecuted, was prosecuted, but was not found guilty of anything, eventually did step down from the force. But right now in New York City, 6 years after Eric Garner's death, we have evidence that of all the COVID arrests, 90% of Black people, and we have several videos showing police officers beating people where they're not even wearing masks. So not only are they abusing people, but they're potentially creating the situation of producing infections, which is the whole point of social distancing. And let me just add that Mayor de Blasio in New York, the largest police agency in the country, who was mayor during the Eric Garner case, was well aware of all that we learned from that. And yet he's the one who's been saying in local media, we're going to arrest you and we're going to issue summons as if you don't follow social distancing. So for all of the evidence that we have about the breakdown of effective, racially just, accountable, egalitarian policing, we keep going back to the same thing. And that is because, let me say this very clearly, the major reason for that is that Black people don't have the political power in this country that white people have on average. And so white men can go armed to courthouses, can get in the faces of police officers, can now, the New York Times is reporting, stand in front of businesses that are in absolute defiance of social distancing orders, and be on the cover of the New York Times, not in a body bag being carried away because the police officers shot them. So we have a problem between what we're aware of and what we're willing to do about it.
I think people may not be aware of this because this is relatively new news. They're certainly aware of what happened in Michigan at the State House, where people brought semi-automatic weapons to a demonstration into the chambers of the State House during a session of their legislature. But yesterday, as you point out, it was reported that in Texas, some of these businesses who are opening against the social distancing rules that Texas has established have either hired or brought in volunteers to surround the premises once again with weapons to challenge anybody who takes issue with their being open. That's in defiance of the law. You're saying that if Black people did that, they'd be under the jailhouse, and white
that's
people
exactly
are getting away
with
it.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I think that's really interesting. There was the headline today, Braxton, in the Charlotte Observer, top of the fold, is that African Americans are afraid to wear masks during this pandemic because it covers up their face. A, it makes them look like criminals. And B, you cannot read a person's expression because the mask is covering their face. White people don't think mm-hmm. about that. What are you hearing in your circle about that? Because that's a public health issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like what Khalil said earlier, is that we have created the biggest system of unfreedom. That we have, and that unfreedom is layered, right? I mean, we're here because the young man in Georgia went jogging, so that we know that whatever we do can be criminalized by our system. That has been the history, even if it isn't written down. We see that in Georgia, that this got beyond police officers, but this got to the district attorney, right? And so the people that are making policy decisions are kind of putting that policy in disproportionate fashion. You know, when we look at masks, we just look at, as you were saying earlier a second ago, when we protested with just our skin in our hands and our voices, you know, we were presented tear gas and flashbangs, but you got people walking around Raleigh with anti-tank missiles and 50 caliber weapons, please step back. That's an issue. That's something I've been trying to wrestle with over the past couple of weeks, because I'm not necessarily an advocate of using more police tactics on people, especially around First Amendment issues. But you see the disconnect, and that's maddeningly frustrating when you think about those things. So this is real. We have, we're seen as a threat, and we potentially can be seen as a more of a threat.
Well, to be fair, having gone through college during the Vietnam War riots and demonstrations, they brought tear gas onto the campus at the University of Maryland, where the student body was profoundly white. At the time, it may not be now, but law enforcement, I think, overreacted to that. They brought in the National Guard. Is that just simply a matter of the people in power wanting to exercise law and order over whomever may want change? Or is it something more deep-seated than that?
Well,
no, again, I mean, I can't say what other people are thinking. But you obviously use force when you see threats and when you see that you can use that force to your advantage.
Derek, we have Braxton Winston, a member of city council, at large, a member of city council. So he represents the entire city. We have a black mayor. We have a black sheriff. We have a black district attorney. We have a black city manager. We have a black police chief. Has that made a difference in our town with regards to what we're talking about today?
That's interesting you bring that up, Mike. And I have had several conversations with different people right there, for both people of color and whites. And the notion that you can, because you have so many blacks that are in leadership position, that things are going to change, I think is, we shouldn't assume that. Because once we understand culture within systems and institutions, once we understand how policies and influence and power shows up. And so then, and then once you still look at the data and look how data is disaggregated by race and gender, it still has nothing to do with who's in leadership. It still has nothing to do with who holds the seat. It's really around the power and influence and those who have the ability to access and resources to really shift and shape policies to benefit one group over the other. If we continue to ask ourselves, you know, when we look in through a racial equity lens, if we ask ourselves who is experienced burden and who is experiencing benefit, our race, and we really have to examine what are the root causes of these inequities that are taking place.
Derek, I'm going to stop you. We'll come back to that when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Rachel Lanz, whose new book called In the Waves explores a deep Southern mystery, the death of the crew of the Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Khalil Gibran Muhammad is with us, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard University, and the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, which we'll return to in a moment. Braxton Winston is city council member at large, and Derek Anderson is executive director of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. And you were in the middle of talking about the root cause of all this and how it's still falling fundamentally on African Americans. Derek, continue your thought there.
Yes, thank you, Mike. One of the things there's a notion to do when you think about the narrative that's being created as it relates to black men versus white men. And when you think about the narrative being created, a lot of it is focused on the actions, the behaviors of black men without the systems, the structure, and policies that coexist. But when we think about this notion again around what is the root cause of inequity, it's not the actions and behaviors of black men or people of color. It's really this notion we talk about institutional racism and white supremacy. And for some reason, we don't really want to continue to talk about that and dig deep to best understand why that's happening, how it's happening. But more importantly, there's this ideology that the ideals and beliefs of whites are superior to the people of color. And when you look at it across every system, across institutions, when you look at all the videos, just in terms of how people are treated differently simply because of their skin color. And the notion that because of your status or your position, your station or your wealth or whatever you have in life is that you can be treated differently. What continues to bother me about this is that when I hear about what took place with any shooting of black men, I think about that could happen to me. That could happen to my brothers. That could happen to my father, my uncles, people, other men, my friends that I love. And it has nothing to do with our attainment in life. I just had a son who celebrated his 14th birthday on Monday, and I'm worried that he's going to go driving, right? And so now you think about the profile and everything that goes on with that whole station and situation, not just me, but for other young Black men, for other fathers that are out there that are concerned about our kids and mothers. And it's a serious problem, but yet there are some who are able to see it as a problem and others are not. But one thing's the fact, the data show that unarmed Black men continue to be killed over and over, and there are a lot of white men who go unpunished. And that's the root cause of this. And it's connected to social capital, it's connected to relationships, and it's connected to the social fabric that some people have an advantage and others do not. And until we're able to recognize it and see it, we have to begin to look at how do we address that.
Kirby emails us to your point about armed people standing outside Texas businesses. The double standard that immediately came to mind was how conservative media stoked fear during the 2008 election because of a single incident of three Black men outside a polling place in Philadelphia, one of whom had a nightstick. And this plays into, Khalil, something that you have said. You've said that to think and talk about African Americans as criminals is something that is encoded in our DNA. In America. How do you scrub that out of the DNA?
Well, we have to fundamentally shift our understanding of inequality, of poverty, of the actual experience of African Americans being overrepresented at the bottom of our economy as a kind of representation of both pathology and potential criminality. And while that might sound up in the air, let me use history to bring it down to earth. This country has always struggled with a mass of whites at the low end of the economic hierarchy. The vast majority of poor people in America are in fact white people. And over time, people who came from European countries, from Italy, from Ireland, from Poland, Russian Jews came from poor parts of Europe. Many of them struggled economically, and within that context were also subject to heavy-handed policing and criminalization and nativism and all the kinds of racism that we know was directed towards European immigrants. How did we get out of that problem? We didn't police our way out of that problem. We actually built a social welfare system, first during the Progressive period and then during the New Deal, which essentially expanded the economic pie to make sure that those working class, working poor, formerly European immigrant, then white Americans had a chance at the quote unquote American dream. And over those precise exact decades, what did we give African Americans? More policing, more prisons, more forms of racial control. And so it's not that we don't know what the recipe is for investing in communities in the way that Derek has described in terms of the social fabric of communities. It is in fact that we have chosen by dint of policy to make sure that when we have scarce resources, they go to white communities first.
Why
what
do we
Black
continue
get is more policing.
Why do we continue to make the same mistake over and over again? Because it's not just in this instance, it's a lot of instances where we use a stick instead of something that would be helpful and could solve the problem.
Yeah, well, I'll be as plain as I can possibly be. There are not enough white people in America who care enough about equality and about fair treatment and racial justice to make a political difference. All these white kids that were laying down for Michael Brown or who were clogging up highways in support of various instances of unarmed Black people being killed, or all these white people who supported Bernie Sanders in the campaign for 2020 presidential election, don't represent the majority of white people's interest around racial justice issues. And so I'll give you a little bit of evidence. In the George Zimmerman acquittal, 80% of whites approved of the verdict. In the case of Stop and Frisk, that kind of brought candidate Mike Bloomberg down in the 2020 presidential race, 60% of white New Yorkers consistently supported Stop and Frisk policies. So Mike, we need more white people to not just be embarrassed or be upset by a cell phone video of a Black person being shot. We need them to act politically to hold the Gwinn County Police Department accountable on day one, on the first report of that news, when the questions and answers weren't making sense, and not just when Black people start making things inconvenient for people. That's going to make a difference, Mike.
You're nodding, Braxton, in agreement.
Yeah, I completely agree. The other thing that I would add to that, in kind of what you mentioned earlier about all the Black leadership, we need folks to give political to help give elected officials the political will to actually do the work and do and make the changes. You know, I came into this and I said we need to take a deep look at all of our policies. And the way we go about doing our business, because that is allowing some of these things, these structures to persevere. And until we kind of step back and really deep dive and deconstruct these systems that perpetuate these inequities, we're not going to get anywhere. And that gets met with a lot of fear and trepidation when that shows up in a headline in a certain kind of way. And people are unwilling to do that. And I can tell you that other elected officials are saying, well, we're not hearing those specific asks coming from the population, so we're not going to do these things. But I'm like, you are hearing that from our constituents, but they're asking for big change and they don't know the specific things that need to be fixed. So unless the public kind of drills down on one specific thing, there is not a lot of political will to do the work to make those changes.
You came into the public consciousness, Braxton, after the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott, and I don't believe you had been an activist per se prior to that, and I know you weren't involved in politics prior to that. You became an activist that led you to politics. Have you been able to have these conversations, meaningful conversations, that you think will put us in the right direction? I know you're only one person on city council, but have you been able to prick their consciences?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I will say that I came on the scene as a concerned citizen. That's something that I've always been. So a lot of the things that I've been saying now on city council are things that I've always been working for in my private life. I don't, regardless of, again, these are things that community members have always worked on, regardless of the labels that are put on folks. But again, that is what I have been working on. But it's very difficult to get people to want to deconstruct or tear down systems and build those things back up. People are very open to add new programs or change parts of the system, hoping that more people get more of the benefit and less people get the shorter end of the stick. But that is the approach that I've been taking. Where is our opportunity to create systems change? And I think that is the best place for a city council member or elected official to try to operate from. And those decisions kind of go downhill and work with the folks that your policies are affecting day to day.
To piggyback on something Khalil was talking about a minute ago, and this actually came in before you were talking about this, Khalil, and emails, I'm a white woman. A Black woman once told me she thought the only way to begin making progress dismantling racism in America is for white people to speak up when they see injustice. People of color have been carrying this torch for far too long. It's time for white people to start calling out racism when they see it. What does this panel believe will move this anti-racism work forward? Derek, you work with the criminal justice system here. Are you alone? Is it all Black people working to this end, or are white people joining you in this cause?
Mike, that's a great question, and that's a very profound statement, and I hear that many times. There are a lot of white allies who are out in this work, shoulder and shoulder, doing their work as well. But it's correct. White people really need to talk to white people as a part of that. One of the things we really have to do to build off what Braxton talked about, it really starts at a system level around how do we address policies. We're not going to program our way out of this. The other thing I think is important for us to ask ourselves, as leaders and influencers, those with power, what conditions of well-being do we want everyone in our community to experience? What is the condition and well-being do we want everyone in our community to experience? And so once we begin to look at that, we have to examine that and understand who is getting benefit, who has an advantage, and who's being disadvantaged by people of color. And again, as it relates to our white allies, they have to continue to show up, share their voice. They have to continue to speak in a way that allows this conversation to move, but also how do we share power? That's one of the things we don't really look at and talk about, how we share in power with communities and people of color in a way that allows their voice, their lived experiences and narratives and stories behind the data to show up as a way, because this work I find is really around our heart and mind. Really around the heart and mind of people who want to do the right thing and willing to have the courage to say the right thing and do the right thing together. What I find so often in this work is that it's really around relationships and building trust. And I think through the process of building relationships and building trust is what we have done at Race Matters for Juvenile Justice over a period of time and building rapport with system leaders and organizations, not as a way to shame and blame, but as a way to encourage, as a way to support, and as a way to how do we travel this road together? With making sure that we clearly focus on, we have to be clear about using a racial equity lens, looking and identifying what is the root cause and doing our own work to address our implicit bias and our blind spots as we journey together.
Khalil, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, just a final thought for me. Listen, you know, William Barber has been doing exactly this kind of work in the state of North Carolina for a long time. And to think about all the white people that he's brought into that tent, people in the western part of the state who have no good reason whatsoever to care about what's happening to black folks in other parts of the state. And yet he's shown how to do that. He's leading the way. But at the same time, you have a state that has a Republican state legislature that stripped the power of the newest governor from some of the things that that fusion movement has been working on. So if more white people want a different kind of America than the one that keeps showing up at the polls, either because of voter suppression or other means, then they have to step up. That this is political work because that's what makes our laws and our governance structures change in America. And the last very quick thought is COVID-19 shows us yet again that, Mike, we don't value all lives the same. And so we want essential workers to show up, right, to make sure that the slaughtering houses produce the meat that we all want at our dinner tables, as many of us privileged shelter in place. But who are those essential workers? They are people of color overwhelmingly. And yet we have a country that is not giving them what they need to be healthy so that the rest of us can live healthy and safe. And so that is right in front of us. And how we come out of this will be yet another opportunity for the majority of Americans in this country to think and do differently.
Yes, when the pressure is on to open the economy, and God knows we need to do that because we don't want to fall into something deeper than the Great Depression, which is where we're headed, I suppose, economically. But the brunt of that is going to fall on the backs of frontline, low-wage workers. And they are predominantly people of color, whether they're African Americans or they're Latinos or others. It's going to fall on them. The mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Bottoms, on Sunday on CNN said that rhetoric from the White House is playing a role in these incidents like the most recent one in Georgia. She said, "I think many who are prone to being racist and are given permission to do it in an overt way, in a way we wouldn't otherwise see in 2020, and she's calling the killing of Ahmaud Arbery a lynching of an African-American man. Do all three of you agree with that, Braxton?
I certainly agree that it was a lynching, and to this point, it was allowed by the state, you know, and yes, I agree.
Derek?
I agree. I mean, if you go back and look at, that's an area point in time we really don't talk much about in history. We talk about slavery, we talk about Jim Crow, but when you think about the period of lynching, during that period of time post-Reconstruction, you're talking about thousands, over 4,500 people lynched. And the question is, were those men held accountable by our justice system for what they've done? And so, yes, this is modern day lynching.
Khalil?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for keeping it short. I appreciate it. You see my finger wagging here. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard, the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Braxton Winston, Charlotte City Council at Large, and Derek Anderson, executive director of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. Thank you all for the hour. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.